Tonight, I'm going to conclude our remarks about the influence of Jesus Christ and the Bible on the world. Last Sunday night, in my absence, Mark spoke, for which I'm very thankful. That allowed me to go home and put together a bicycle which didn't have the right instructions in the box with it and still get to the birthday party in time for my granddaughter to receive it for her fourth birthday. And we had a fine time. She had a fine time. She announced to her mama this morning, or this afternoon after they got home from church, said, "Mama, I went to the four-year-old class today in Sunday school." It was her first time to be in the four-year-old class. So that was very important to her. Ernest Hemingway is recorded to have said, "All thinking men are atheists." Gene Roddenberry, probably best known for the creation and the directing of the famous original television series Star Trek, said, "For most people, religion is nothing more than a substitute for a malfunctioning brain." The man we usually call Mark Twain, whose real name was Samuel Clemens, great author and humorist, said, "I cannot see how a man of any large degree of humorous perception can ever be religious unless he purposely shut his eyes of his mind and keeps them shut by force." It's a widely held perception that intelligent people aren't believers. That is a misperception. It's a well-recognized practice in debate, argument, logic, politics, and feuding between kids, that if you can belittle someone else and paint them as being in the same category with someone or something that is despicable or inferior, that you've made some kind of point in your argument, whether it's actually true or not. How many of us remember, if we had teenagers, them arguing, "Well, everybody does it," or "Nobody wears that," or "Nobody does this"? Of course, those statements weren't really true. It just so happened that nobody they wanted to be like did it, or everybody they wanted to hang out with did this. And so we'll often hear people on both sides of many kinds of arguments tending to characterize everyone else in the other camp as being like a few who may be in that other camp. We even see it sometimes in advertising. There's been sort of a hubbub going on in the computer world over the last year or two as the Apple computer company that produces a line of computers called Macintosh have come out with commercial after commercial that makes fun of computers that use the Windows operating system. And at first, Microsoft, who makes the Windows operating system, cried foul. Not fair. Inaccurate. But now, after about a year and a half to almost 2 years of those commercials running and new ones coming out all the time, Microsoft is actually admitting that it has hurt their business, whether they're accurate or not. And so this kind of practice of misrepresenting those who disagree with you happens in all sorts of areas. Well, it even happens within religion among different people of religious conviction. We might think or even say that all people who are of such and such a church believe this way. Probably not true. That's, of course, what Senator Obama is struggling against right now, is because of some radical statements by a couple of ministers and the denomination that he's a part of, he's finally felt like he's got to distance himself from the whole church because he knows that people will tend to paint him with the same stigma as these other men have painted themselves with. Well, so in this field of religion and science and so forth, there are those who are outspoken critics of religion in general, and maybe of Christianity in particular, who will try to paint all of those who believe in Christianity or in the Bible as being ignoramuses, are unintelligent, are non-thinking, are ignoring the facts of the case, and conveniently choose to ignore the fact that at least a large, significant minority of their fellow scientists are believers. They never even give credit to that. But because they're really not complaining about their fellow scientists, they're complaining about other religionists. So I want to just talk a little bit tonight about how, particularly the Bible, and of course through the Bible, then Jesus Christ, has had a tremendous positive impact on the scientific world in all sorts of different ways. And I know I couldn't anywhere near outline all of those ways. But the first thing I've observed over the years, I keep reading not just history itself, but even the history of science and the history of different scientific fields of study. One of the first things you start observing is that almost every significant field of science had its modern origin with a man or a group of men with Christian convictions. Now, this really makes some people struggle, because you would think that, well, what about Buddhists? What about Hindus? What about Muslims? What about atheists? Historians struggle to find hardly any scientists in any of those fields who are credited with being the fathers, so to speak, of their particular field of study. That doesn't mean there aren't many people of those convictions in those fields. There probably are today. But if you go back in time to the Reformation period, the Renaissance period of time, starting in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, even up into the 1800s, you're going to find the overwhelming preponderance of scientists who are recognized as, you know, if there was such a list of the 100 greatest scientists of all time, the great preponderance of those men and women will be men and women of deep Christian conviction. J. Robert Oppenheimer, a nuclear physicist, not a Christian, the man who was deeply involved in the development of nuclear physics as we know it today, and of course the atomic bomb and nuclear bomb and so forth in the 1940s and early 1950s. In one of his books says, he wrote a book on the history of science. In one of those books he says, the earliest scientists also shared the outlook of Christianity in believing that there is a reasonable God who has created a reasonable universe, and thus man, by use of his reason, could find out that universe's form. All Oppenheimer was saying is that there's something about Christianity's view of the world as a whole that fosters science. And it turns out, because Christianity says there is absolutes, there are knowables, there's explanations for things, and we ought to pursue those questions to find answers, that very underpinning of Christianity itself gives rise to science, because that's what science is trying to do. In spite of the fact that for many now, science has, in their mind at least, has replaced God as an adequate explanation for where everything came from. I tried to make a list of a few of the early scientists, many of them known as I said, the father of modern science in their fields, and who were deep believers. For example, Francis Bacon. He's the man, I remember studying him in history, that he is credited with what's called the modern scientific method. He's the one that proposed in a organized form experimentation and putting forth a hypothesis and testing that, and if it seems to be moving in that direction, you move on from hypothesis to theory, and eventually if you keep doing testing and it keeps coming out the same way, eventually you formulate what is considered a natural law. That's Francis Bacon. Lived well over 300 years ago. He said, there are two books laid before us to study to prevent our falling into error. First, the volume of the Scriptures, which reveal the will of God, Then, the volume of creation, which is an expression of His power. You see, His very conviction about those things is what led Him to start proposing a more organized study of the sciences. In the 1600s, a man by the name of Robert Boyle in England, now often referred to as the father of modern chemistry, and even has one or two principles of science named after him. Boyle's Law, I remember studying. It has something to do with, I can't remember all the details anymore, but it has something to do with gases and their volume and pressure and all of those kind of things. It's a well-recognized, formulated law. In addition to all of his study in chemistry and many advances he made there that led to others making even other advances, he also was a prolific author of books on Christian apologetics, arguing for the truthfulness and reasonableness of Christianity. He also, because he spoke three other languages besides English, spent part of his life translating various Christian tracts and booklets into other languages, so people who spoke those other languages could have the benefit we who speak English do of reading the truth in their own language. And at his death, in his will, he had left the larger portion, or at least a large portion, of his rather considerable estate by that time to a special fund called the Boyle Lectures Fund to fund the further teaching of the Christian religion by other scientists who would follow him. He saw science and Christianity as just two parts of the same thing. Sir Michael Faraday, in the early 1800s, the father of modern study of electromagnetism, did a lot of study of the whole thing of magnets, and especially if you know you run a current through a coiled wire and an iron bar through the middle of it, you create an electromagnet, but also discovered that electromagnetism could bend light and all sorts of other things that he's credited with. He said, "The Bible and it alone, with nothing added to it nor taken away from it by man, is the sole and sufficient guide for each individual at all times in all circumstances." Now, some modern scientists may choose to say that only unintelligent people believe the Bible. But I just wonder if they genuinely believe that. For these are the men on whose shoulders they stand. And yet these men say that it's their conviction about these things of a spiritual religious nature that gave rise to their study over in their scientific endeavors. Johannes Kepler, one of the fathers of astronomy, often thought of, along with Galileo, both of which were very devout believers, in spite of the fact that Galileo ran into problems with the church in his day because there was a misunderstanding of what the scriptures taught as opposed to what people traditionally believed about something, and that got Galileo into all sorts of trouble. But he never gave up his Christian faith. Neither did Johannes Kepler. He is the one who finally formulated the whole idea in a comprehensive way that could be demonstrated that not only is the Earth and the other planets moving around the sun, up until that time the majority of people believed, and this is part of what Galileo got in trouble for, that the sun and the other planets all moved around the Earth, that we were the center of God's universe from the standpoint of orbits. Kepler is the one who finally did both the observation and the mathematics to show that in fact all of our planets move around the sun, even as the moon moves around the Earth, and even was able to demonstrate that the sun itself is moving through space, and although he didn't have the equipment or means to know how, probably itself was rotating around something else or orbiting something else, which now is a demonstrable fact. And he said, "It is my wish that I may perceive the God whom I find everywhere in the external world." He just wanted to see God's world and understand it. In another place, he said, "God is supremely rational, and the human being is also rational, being created in the image and likeness of God." And there's many more. Sir Isaac Newton, the father of modern calculus, the formulator of the laws of gravity, at least in their seminal form as we know them now, also a great student of the whole subject of light. And much of our later understanding of light started with Sir Isaac Newton, who lived in the late 1600s, early 1700s, a devout believer. Charles Babbage, you might not have ever heard of him. He lived in the 1800s, but he's near and dear to me because he's often referred to as the father of computer science. He was the one that first started formulating things like the binary system and how it might be possible to make machines that could do calculations, even though they didn't even have electronics or anything yet. And he even designed a form of mechanical computer. And even today, the design he came up with is referred to as the Babbage computing engine, or calculating engine. And about the same time, or a little before him, was another man named Blaise Pascal, I think French, mathematician. He actually built a mechanical adding machine, believe it or not, in the 1600s that worked. Devout believer. Samuel F. B. Morse, inventor of the telegraph. Up until the time of television, next to the invention of printing, the invention of the telegraph was considered possibly one of the most important inventions in history. Devout believer. George Washington Carver. He's often credited as being the father of agricultural science. Hundreds and hundreds of discoveries in the fields of agriculture. And of course, blazed the way in other ways too, because he was African American and helped farmers, particularly across the South, learn how to raise better crops and even change the crops they were raising to have better incomes for their family and produce better foods to feed our world. And there's so many more. I guess one area that really stuck in my mind just in the last couple of days, because one of the last things I did yesterday before I left my house to start making my way down here, was I watched the space shuttle take off again. You know, it was heading to the space station, carrying three bits of cargo, a huge space lab that's cost about $2 billion to build, primarily designed and built by the Japanese, a backup pump for the bathroom on board the space station because the one they have has quit working, and there isn't a plan B on the space station, and a 12-inch tall action figure of Buzz Lightyear. Believe it or not, someone at NASA has a sense of humor, and they're actually gradually building a collection on board the space station. Every time a shuttle goes up, it carries another action figure from some aspect of toys in space. And so this time they get Buzz Lightyear. It was Frank Borman on board Apollo 8, the first man-made, manned object to leave the orbit of Earth and go further out into space, who shocked the world by coming on board the radio of Apollo 8 and reading, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." He was expressing his own personal faith in what he was seeing out the window of the Apollo spacecraft as he was one of the first men to get a view of Earth from that perspective. And to him, it only spoke of the creation of God. On board Apollo 11, that was the one that landed on the moon, that carried Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin. We know the famous words as Neil Armstrong steps out onto the moon's surface, about one small step for man, but one giant step for mankind. What you don't know, perhaps, is that before he stepped out onto the moon, before they pulled on their space helmets so they could breathe out there, Buzz Aldrin took out a communion set on board the lunar lander, and he and Neil Armstrong took communion. That's well documented, but not well known. Apollo 15, Colonel Jim Irwin, deeply religious. After finishing his work with a space program, died in 1991, He went on to become a minister of the gospel, founding an organization called the High Flight Foundation, an interdenominational evangelical ministry that was based in Colorado Springs. Charles Duke, Brigadier General, U.S. Air Force, lunar module pilot on board Apollo 16, is still today an active speaker and Christian lay minister, and has established his own organization called the Duke Ministry for Christ, in which he goes around speaking about the not the space program so much, but as a man in the space program and having Christian faith. Two, probably more than that, but at least two of the astronauts on board the ill-fated space shuttle Columbia were ardent believers, actually both members of the same church, Rick Husband and Michael Anderson, and were not at all ashamed to confess their faith and the one they believe created the world and everything in it. What is it about science or scientists that causes them to be attracted to the Bible? We find those that seem to be repelled by it. But what is it that is so attractive to men like these? And by the way, I discovered yesterday in doing my final research for this, I found one website on the internet where over 1,600 men of science, many of them with doctorates and in research positions and in professorships and so forth at major universities around the world. This one website had over 1,600 scientists listed who are public professors of their Christian faith. And it's probably only a small, we're sure, only a small fraction of all those who have such faith. But here's some of the things I thought up, and I'll finish. For them, for those who believe, they find the Bible's explanation of where the world came from and why it is as it is. The idea of a creator, a supreme being, a maker, a lawgiver, a sustainer, a maintainer of our universe. They find that an adequate framework for understanding the world. But more than adequate, a preferable one to the only other competing explanation, which is the one the agnostic and atheistic scientists have to put forward, of which one small part is evolution, but it's unfair to say that the whole thing is about evolution. But just the idea that it has either always been here or there was some kind of a big bang of which we can't explain the origin that gave rise to all of this. These men say that's not an adequate explanation. That doesn't fit what we see. And for them, the evidence that the Bible's explanation is true, the evidence is sufficient. And they don't find a conflict with that faith and their scientific endeavors. But more than that, they have found and seen in the Bible, as many have besides them, many pre-scientific statements in the Bible, many things in the Bible we're not going to take a look at tonight, but that indicate that there was knowledge beyond the ability of man himself to know already written into the Bible, hundreds and sometimes even thousands of years before we discovered it by scientific method. And then one more thing is the moral, ethical, and rational foundation that the Bible gives, they find much preferable to a view of the world that says there is no right and wrong. There is no up and down. There is no good and bad. They find that a much more valuable way to look at the world and much more reasonable way than what those who reject the Bible have come up with. Dr. Francis S. Collins. He's been in the news lately, whether you realize it or not. We're not hearing much about it today, but 2 years ago, we were hearing a great deal about what's called the National Human Genome Research Institute. This is a study of human DNA that has gotten deeper into this building block that makes up our bodies and determines what we are and who we are. And scientists one day hope even to discover then, does problems with DNA actually create cancer and other things, or at least a propensity for that? And they hope to make great medical advances eventually because of that. Dr. Francis S. Collins is the director of the National Human Genome Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland. He currently leads the Human Genome Project, which is the project for mapping and sequencing all human DNA and doing all sorts of other things I can't even say the words for, much less understand what they mean. But he says, I think there's a common assumption that you cannot both be a rigorous, show-me-the-data scientist and a person who believes in a personal God. I would like to say that from my perspective, that assumption is incorrect. That in fact, these two areas are entirely compatible and not only can exist within the same person, but can exist in a very synthetic way and not in a compartmentalized way. I have no reason to see a discord between what I know as a scientist who spends all day studying the genome of humans and what I believe as somebody who pays a lot of attention to what the Bible has taught me about God and about Jesus Christ. Those are entirely compatible views. Science is the way, a powerful way indeed, to study the natural world. Science is not particularly effective. In fact, it's rather ineffective in making any kind of commentary about the supernatural world. Both worlds, for me, are quite real and quite important. They are just investigated in different ways. He appeared on CNN and made those statements. The Bible has had a tremendous effect on science. Some historians, as we've said, have said that without Christianity, there probably wouldn't be modern science because it gave both the foundation for and the motivation for the study of the world around us in an organized way, believing, as those early scientists and many modern scientists still believe, that they're just doing a study of what God's already done. They're just learning what God's done. There's a big deal in the news here, couldn't be more than a couple of weeks ago, a letter written by Albert Einstein in which he had said in that letter to someone near the end of his life, I believe, that he didn't believe in a personal God. And a man who's a prominent scientist, I believe in Germany, paid over $400,000 for that letter in public bidding. Unfortunately, that letter doesn't tell the whole story because Einstein is on record numerous times to not only say he didn't believe in a personal God, but also to say there's no other way to explain the universe other than that there's a creator. He just didn't think that we could know him personally, but he did believe there was a creator. He didn't believe there was any other way to explain it, even so far as to make statements such as that he just hoped to think God's thoughts after him. What we have in our possession is not just a wonderful book and an amazing book, but a book that has changed the world in such a way and in so many ways that it's incalculable. There's no other way to measure just how great the impact of it has been. But ultimately, of course, the greatest impact is in each one of us individually, our personal lives, our view of the world, our view of people, our view of God, our view of ourselves, our understanding, and how we should live and what we should do. We have an invitation song. It invites us to think about these things and if there's any way we can help each other in our relationship with the Creator of this world, who we can know through the pages of the Bible, and you can come and let us know what we can do to help while we stand up and sing the song. Let's stand.